Chapter 9. Will the future be good or bad? Sentience as a single life. In the opening of this book, I asked you to consider humanity as a single life, where you live every human life that has ever been lived, reincarnated into one after the other. Let's return to this thought experiment and ask some further questions. First, has it all been worth it? If you lived through every life up until today, would you think that your life has been good on balance? Are you glad that you lived those 100 billion lives? Second, when you look to the future, is it with a sense of optimism or dread? If you found out that the human race was certain to peter out within the next few centuries, would you greet that knowledge with sadness because of all the joys you would lose, or with a sense of relief because of all the horrors you would avoid? And let's reflect on how our answers to these questions might change if we altered the thought experiment. Rather than living through just the 100 billion human lives that have existed to date, imagine that instead you live through the lives of all sentient creatures. The first invertebrate brains evolved over 500 million years ago. We don't know when the first flame of consciousness was kindled, that is, when the first experience occurred, but it might have been not so long after. For this thought experiment, however, let us make the conservative assumption that only vertebrates are sentient. If you lived through the lives of all conscious beings, you would then experience 100 billion trillion years of sentience. You would spend nearly 80% of your time as a fish. You would spend 20% of your time, 30 billion trillion years, as an amphibian or reptile. You would spend 1 quadrillion years living as various kinds of dinosaurs before dying because of an asteroid impact in the last mass extinction. Your time as a mammal would make up only 1/1000th of your existence. Your life as a human being would amount to only 100 billionth of your time on Earth. If this were your life, the evolution of Homo sapiens would be a jarring event. For the first time, you would no longer merely be experiencing, you would also be able to understand and conceptualize your experiences. During this time, the natural environments you had been living in would be progressively destroyed, and you would find yourself experiencing, for the first time, the many lives of animals bred and slaughtered for human consumption. If you were living through the lives of all sentient beings, would you regard the evolution of Homo sapiens as a good thing? And, looking ahead, if you knew you were going to experience all future sentient lives, including those of any sentient artificial beings that might one day be created, would you feel optimistic? This thought experiment sets the stage for the question that this chapter addresses. Should we expect the continuation of civilization into the distant future to be a good thing, morally speaking? Or should we think that, if civilization were to end in the next few centuries, the world would be better off for it? This is a crucial question for long-termists, because it affects how we should prioritize among our efforts. Let's call those who think that the prospective future is good optimists, and those who think that the prospective future is bad, pessimists. The more optimistic we are, the more important it is to avoid permanent collapse or extinction. The less optimistic we are, the stronger the case for focusing instead on improving values or other trajectory changes. Philosophers have been divided on this question of how optimistic or pessimistic we should be about the future. The notoriously dour Schopenhauer, for example, suggested that it would have been much better if the sun had been able to call up the phenomenon of life as little on the earth as on the moon, and if, here as there, the surface were still in crystalline condition. More prosaically, David Benatar recently claimed that although the prospect of human extinction may, in some ways, be bad for us, it would be better, all things considered, if there were no more people, and indeed, no more conscious life. In contrast, in his last work, On What Matters, Parfit took an optimistic stance, commenting, "Just as we had ancestors who were not human, we may have descendants who will not be human. We can call such people suprahuman. Our descendants might, I believe, make the further future very good. Life can be wonderful as well as terrible, and we shall increasingly have the power to make life good. Since human history may be only just beginning, we can expect that future humans, or suprahumans, may achieve some great goods that we cannot now even imagine. In Nietzsche's words, there has never been such a new dawn and clear horizon, and such an open sea. The question of the value of the future is tricky, but I'll suggest that, all things considered, we should expect the future to be positive on balance. I'll first discuss whether the world is good on balance for people alive today, and whether it's getting better or worse. I'll then do the same for non-human animals, and for what philosophers call non-welfarist goods. Finally, I'll discuss how we should weigh up goods against bads, and give an argument for optimism about the long-term future. How many people have positive well-being? Let's start our investigation into the value of the future by asking whether, right now, the world is better than nothing for the human beings alive today. Do most people have lives that are positive, on balance? This topic is a sensitive and difficult one, but it seems to be possible for people to have lives of negative well-being. If someone's life consists only of intense suffering and torture, it clearly makes sense to say that their life is bad for them. As I emphasized last chapter, this is not to say that their lives are not worth living. Someone could have a life such that they would prefer to have never been born, and yet contribute enormously to society through their work and their relationships. Rather, it is to say that, from that person's perspective, putting to the side any effects on others, their life involves so much suffering that it is worse than non-existence. You might ask, who am I to judge what lives are above or below neutral? The sentiment here is a good one. We should be extremely cautious in trying to figure out how good or bad others' lives are, as it's so hard to understand the experiences of people with lives very different to one's own. The answer is to rely primarily on people's self-reports. As we'll see, the best evidence regarding how many people in the world today have lives that are below neutral comes from simply asking people to say, in their own view, whether their lives contain more suffering than happiness, or whether they would prefer to have never been born. The question of how many people have lives of positive well-being, and what it is that makes their lives good, is not just important for long-termists. It's also relevant, for example, for governments deciding how to prioritize healthcare resources. If you think that most people have only slightly positive well-being, then you will be more inclined to favor funding interventions that improve lives, such as treating chronic pain, over policies that save lives, such as preventing malaria. If you think that most people have great lives, then saving lives becomes comparatively more important. Remarkably, the leading approach to measuring the burden of disease, which is widely used by governments and philanthropists when setting healthcare policy, assumes that death is the worst possible state one can be in, even though this is clearly false. It thereby systematically biases policies towards saving life over improving quality of life. You might think it's obvious that the vast majority of people have lives with net positive well-being. I certainly think I have such a life, and you might feel the same. But I am extremely unrepresentative of the world as a whole. And if you're listening to this book, you probably are too. More than half the people in the world live on less than $7 per day, and that figure already accounts for the fact that money goes so much further in poor countries. It represents the equivalent of what $7 would buy in the United States. I would not, intuitively, regard myself as exceptionally wealthy. I live on an income that's only a little higher than the median income in the UK. But even given this, I'm a full 15 times richer than the majority of people in the world. I therefore shouldn't expect to be able to imagine the life and well-being of the average person alive today, let alone the poorest billion people alive. In order to assess whether most people have net positive well-being, the first thing we need to be clear about is what well-being is. In moral philosophy, there are three main theories of well-being. The first is the preference satisfaction view, according to which your life goes well to the degree to which your carefully considered preferences about your life are fulfilled. In this view, your life going well is about getting what you want, even if that does not impact your conscious experiences in any way. For example, you might have a preference for your partner to be faithful to you, even in situations where you would never know either way. The second view is hedonism, according to which your well-being is entirely determined by your conscious experiences. Positive experiences, like pleasure or tranquility, make your life better, while negative experiences, like pain or sadness, make your life worse. In this view, getting what you want does not make your life better unless it improves the balance of positive and negative conscious experiences. If someone wants to become rich and succeeds, but they have just the same balance of negative and positive experiences as before, the hedonist would say that this person's life has not improved merely by virtue of getting what they wanted. The third view is what's called the objective list view. In this view, there are many things that can improve your well-being, even if they do not improve your conscious experiences, and even if you don't desire them. This is why they are called objective goods. These could include things like friendship, the appreciation of beauty, or knowledge. The questions I address in this chapter are particularly hard to assess in the objective list view, not least because there is such a diversity of objective goods. So I have to put them to the side, although I have a section on non-well-being goods, which will help shed some light on the issue. Unfortunately, despite the importance of the issue of how many people have net positive lives, the psychological data we have on it is extremely limited. Out of 170,000 books and papers published on subjective well-being, only a handful have directly addressed the question of for whom life is positive on balance. There are three main psychological approaches that bear on this issue. First are surveys that try to measure people's life satisfaction. Life satisfaction surveys ask respondents to rate their lives as a whole on a scale from 0 to 10, where 10 represents the best possible life for them and 0 represents the worst possible life for them. Survey data of more than 1.5 million people from 166 countries found that, from 2005 to 2015, only 47% of respondents had mean scores above 5. For our purposes, though, what we need to know is how survey respondents interpret the scale, and in particular, where the neutral point is, the point on the scale below which they think a life is so bad that it's worse, for them personally, than being alive. We can't assume that this is the midpoint of the scale. Indeed, it's clear that respondents aren't interpreting the question literally. The best possible life, a 10, for me, would be one of constant perfect bliss. The worst possible life, a 0, for me would be one of the most excruciating torture. Compared to these two extremes, perhaps my life, and the lives of everyone today, might vary between 4.9 and 5.1. But, when asked, people tend to spread their scores across the whole range, often giving 10s or 0s. This suggests that people are relativizing their answers to what is realistically attainable in their country or the world at present. A study from 2016 found that respondents who gave themselves a 10 out of 10 would often report significant life issues. One 10 out of 10 respondent mentioned that they had an aortic aneurysm, had had no relationship with their father since his return from prison, had had to take care of their mother until her death, and had been in a horrible marriage for 17 years. The relative nature of the scale means that it is difficult to interpret where the neutral point should be, and unfortunately, there have been only two small studies directly addressing this question. Respondents from Ghana and Kenya put the neutral point at 0.6, while one British study places it between 1 and 2. It is difficult to know how other respondents might interpret the neutral point. If we take the UK survey on the neutral point at face value, then between 5 and 10% of people in the world would have lives that are below neutral. All in all, although they provide by far the most comprehensive data on life satisfaction surveys mainly provide insights into relative levels of well-being across different people, countries, and demographics. They do not provide much guidance on people's absolute level of well-being, A second line of evidence is from surveys that simply ask people if they are happy. The World Values Survey asks respondents whether they are very happy, rather happy, not very happy, or not at all happy. The last survey was in 2014 and included respondents from 60 countries, comprising 67% of the world population. It found that in all countries except Egypt, which was undergoing a protracted political crisis at the time, more than half of people rate themselves as very happy or rather happy, and in almost all countries, more than 70% of people say they are happy. In several countries, reported rates of happiness are extremely high. In Qatar, 98% of people say they are happy, as do 95% of Swedes and 91% of Americans. Even in a poor country like Rwanda, 90% of people say they are happy. These ratings are probably overly optimistic. For example, in 2013, one survey found that 11% of Swedish adults were experiencing clinical depression at a particular point in time. But in the World Values Survey, only 5% of Swedes rated themselves as unhappy. The third line of evidence on whether people have lives with positive well-being comes from early and intriguing work using an experiential approach to measuring well-being, asking people at random times how they feel in that moment. This is known as experience sampling. Those who favour this method of measuring happiness argue that it avoids some of the biases inherent in the life satisfaction approach, such as that people might have a selective memory, or that questions about life satisfaction measure people's perception of their own social status rather than their happiness. In a currently unpublished large survey of over 8,500 people, psychologists Matt Killingsworth, Lisa Stewart, and Joshua Green added a twist to the experience sampling approach. At random times, they asked participants to write down what activity they were doing and how long it would last, and then respond to the question, "If you could, and it had no negative consequences, would you jump forward in time to the end of what you're currently doing?" That is, they asked participants to imagine having the option of simply not experiencing, though still doing, whatever activity they were engaged in at that moment. If they were making a cup of tea, they would imagine that they could blink and their next experience would be drinking the cup of tea that they had just made. The researchers called this skipping an experience. The idea underlying the question was that if someone would choose to skip an experience, they were judging that experience to be worse than nothing. If someone chose to keep an experience, they were judging that experience to be better than nothing. It turns out that people in the survey, on average, would skip around 40% of their day if they could. In a second, smaller study, the same experimenters asked people to look back at the previous day and indicate which experiences they would have skipped if they could, and then asked them to compare pairs of experiences with each other to work out how good the experiences they'd have kept were and how bad the experiences they would have skipped were. For instance, a study subject might say that 30 minutes of an activity they'd rather skip, say housework, was worth 15 minutes of an enjoyable activity, say dinner with friends. This would indicate that, for this study subject, having dinner with friends is twice as good per minute as doing housework is bad. Again, people skipped around 40% of their day, and on average, people were happier during the times they kept than they were unhappy during the times they skipped. Taking both duration and intensity into account, the negative experiences were only bad enough to cancel out 58% of people's positive experiences. The sorts of experiences people kept and skipped were what you might expect. People skipped 69% of the time they were working, and only 2% of the time they were engaged in what the experimenters euphemistically called intimate activities. In the smaller of the two studies, in which intensity of experience was measured, 12% of people had lives where, on the day in question, negative experiences outweighed the positive. This does not necessarily mean that 12% of people have lives of negative well-being. These respondents might just have had a bad day. The results of these studies might seem like positive news, seeing as the participants in the study had good lives on average. But I think the right conclusion is actually more pessimistic. The participants in these studies mainly lived in the United States or in other countries with comparatively high income levels and levels of happiness. And the ones in the larger study all owned an iPhone. In 2016, Apple was the consumer brand that best predicted whether a purchaser was rich and well-educated. In 1992, the brand that best predicted income was Grey Poupon mustard. The skipping studies were therefore somewhat skewed towards wealthier and better educated people, and the results were not representative of the lives of prisoners, who in the United States constitute 0.7% of the population, or the homeless, 0.17% of the US population. Yet, even within such a selected sample, participants said they would choose to skip 40% of their life. Their bad experiences cancelled out nearly 60% of their good experiences, and for more than a tenth of people, negative experiences outweighed the positive. Overall, while the study is highly intriguing and well done, it's limited in what it tells us about global happiness. Because the published evidence we have so far is so limited, I commissioned three psychologists, Lucius Caviola, Abigail Novick-Hoskin, and Joshua Lewis, to run a survey on the topic. They asked 240 people in the United States and 240 people in India a range of questions on the quality of their life so far, including these. Do you think that your life to date has involved more happiness than suffering? Ignoring any effects of your life on other people, would you prefer to be alive, or would you prefer to have never been born? If you could live the exact same life again from the beginning, without remembering anything from before, so you would experience everything as if for the first time, would you do it? Assume this decision affects no one else, and you are just deciding for your own benefit. They also asked for qualitative comments. One respondent simply said, "Those are some deep questions, man." Those who gave positive answers often wrote quite beautiful responses, such as, "I'm happy I was born to experience so many things, such as the births of my nieces and nephews and many children I have watched grow. I also love the wonder of it all. The birds, butterflies, trees, rivers are all so beautiful." The comments from those who gave negative answers were as dark as one might expect, such as, "My life was and is a horrible thing. I would not want to relive it again." And, "I have lived through pure hell the last 20 years of my life, and I would not wish it on anyone." Positive answers were much more common than negative answers. In the United States, 16% said their life contained more suffering than happiness, and 40% said it contained more happiness than suffering. 9% preferred never to have been born, and 79% preferred to be alive. 30% would not live the exact same life again, and 44% would. The results were similar in India, although strikingly, Indian respondents were more positive than those from the United States. Only 11% thought their lives contained more suffering than happiness, only 6% preferred never to have been born, and only 19% would choose not to live their life again. This might be simply because the samples were not representative of the population as a whole. Respondents tended to be comparatively well-off Indians and comparatively less well-off Americans. How should we put this all together? The conclusions we come to will vary depending on the theory of well-being we invoke. Life satisfaction scores, in which people rate their own happiness, seem to more closely track a preference satisfaction view, since people saying they are satisfied with their life is evidence that their preferences are being satisfied. The skipping studies more closely track a hedonistic view of welfare. Even if people desire to be in their job, for instance, the evidence suggests that many of them do not enjoy it very much, and the skipping study captures that fact. The World Values Survey, which directly asks people whether they are happy, is perhaps most naturally interpreted in a preference satisfactionist way. But one could imagine that some respondents also interpreted it in a hedonist way. I would tentatively suggest that something like 10% of the global population have lives with below neutral well-being. If we assume, following the small UK survey, that the neutral point on a life satisfaction scale is between 1 and 2, then 5 to 10% of the global population have lives of negative well-being. In the World Values Survey, 17% of respondents classed themselves as unhappy. In the smaller skipping study of people in rich countries, 12% of people had days where their bad experiences outweighed the good. And in the study that I commissioned, fewer than 10% of people in both the United States and India said they wished they had never been born, and a little over 10% said that their lives contained more suffering than happiness. So, I would guess that on either preference satisfactionism or hedonism, most people have lives with positive well-being. If I were given the option, on my deathbed, to be reincarnated as a randomly selected person alive today, I would choose to do so. If I were to live through the lives of everyone alive today, I would be glad to have lived. Next, let's ask how human well-being is changing over time. Are people getting happier or staying much the same? Are people getting happier? A common view is that even though the world is getting richer, people are no happier or are even becoming less happy. In support of this view, one could point to the Easterlin paradox. Although higher income is correlated with greater happiness, both within and across countries, at a specific point in time, over time, people and countries do not get any happier as they get richer. In this view, it's relative income within a country that determines a person's happiness. Our absolute level of income is irrelevant because we get accustomed to whatever level of income we have. In this view, then, insofar as income inequality within countries is generally increasing over time, we might expect people to get less happy over time. However, though Easterlin's paradox continues to be influential, it doesn't actually exist. Easterlin first published his findings back in 1974, when the data we had about levels of happiness around the world was much more sparse than it is today. From the fact that we could not, at the time, show that countries get happier as they get richer, he concluded that there was no relationship between absolute level of income and happiness, and that happiness was instead determined by one's income relative to one's peers. But more recent work with better data strongly supports the view that countries get happier as they get richer. It may well be that your relative level of income within your country influences how happy you are, but it's also true that your happiness increases with your absolute level of income. Even though richer people tend to be happier, it is not clear whether this effect is causal. Maybe happier people are easier to work with, and so tend to earn more money. One way to explore the causal effect of money on happiness is by looking at lottery winners. Newspapers and magazines often report about the so-called curse of the lottery, of newly minted but miserable millionaires. In 2016, Time magazine published a piece called "Here's How Winning the Lottery Makes You Miserable," with several anecdotes of people whose lives had been ruined by fabulous wealth. The only exception mentioned in the article was Richard Lustig, who won substantial lottery prizes, no fewer than 7 times, and wrote the book "Learn How to Increase Your Chances of Winning the Lottery." Lustig said, "I've been rich and I've been poor, and I like rich a whole lot better." It turns out that Lustig's experience is actually more representative of lottery winners as a whole. Recent research has found that lottery winners are happier. This is further evidence for the view that money does improve people's well-being. One study found that in countries experiencing sustained economic growth, happiness inequality has been decreasing over time, even in countries which have also experienced rising income inequality. This is true across socioeconomic classes and across different races. The authors of the study suggest that as countries get richer, their governments spend more on things like health, infrastructure, and social protection, which affect incomes and happiness differently. Similarly, in the United States, the black-white happiness gap has closed by 2/3 since the 1970s, although today white Americans remain happier on average, even after controlling for differences in education and income. Inequality between self-reported happiness scores has also decreased between genders, but this might not be for the reason you think. Surprisingly, it's because women have gotten less happy over time. They used to report being happier than men, but now they are similar in happiness to men. It's not currently known why this trend has occurred. These broad improvements in human well-being are an important corrective to the widespread belief that the world is getting worse and will continue to do so. There is lots of evidence that people are far too pessimistic about how the rest of the world is doing. A 2015 survey of 18,000 adults found that in many rich countries, less than 10% of respondents think the world is getting better. This pessimism is driven in part by the negative skew of news. A huge plane crash makes for compelling news, but a long-sustained decline in child mortality is not worth mentioning. If it bleeds, it leads. This leads us to focus on the bad and ignore the good, so we miss the huge improvements that are happening all around us. These trends, though, do not give reasons for thinking that the problems in the world today are not so bad after all. I mentioned earlier that most people still live on less than $7 per day. In addition, every year millions die from easily preventable diseases, millions more are oppressed and abused, and hundreds of millions of people go hungry. This is not a world we should be content with. Moreover, average human well-being has not increased inexorably upwards throughout all of human history. While living standards today are undoubtedly much higher than they were in pre-industrial agricultural societies, our nomadic hunter-gatherer ancestors, from the dawn of Homo sapiens up until the agricultural revolution around 10,000 years ago, probably had higher average well-being than early agriculturalists. As people relied more on agriculture, their height, a good indicator of nutrition and health, usually declined compared to that of their hunter-gatherer ancestors. There is even some evidence that, in some ways, the lives of pre-agricultural hunter-gatherers were quite attractive compared to the life of the average person alive today. Although measurement is difficult, on average, the working hours of modern hunter-gatherers are not dramatically different from those in modern industrial societies, and for some hunter-gatherers, they are much lower. Moreover, many hunter-gatherers enjoy their work. After all, hunting is a popular recreational activity for many people today. Hunter-gatherers usually have a strong egalitarian ethos and high levels of community, and they dance and sing regularly. In his study of the Hadza from Tanzania, one of the few remaining hunter-gatherer societies in the world, the anthropologist Frank Marlowe noted, "The Hadza sing often, and everyone can sing very well. When several Hadza get in my Land Rover to go somewhere, they almost invariably begin singing. They use a melody they all know, but make up lyrics on the spot. These lyrics may go something like, 'Here we go riding in Frankie's car, riding here and there in the car. When Frankie comes, we go riding in the car.' They take different parts in a three-part harmony, never missing a beat, all seemingly receiving the improvised lyrics telepathically. They also love to dance and do so in various distinct styles. This dancing is unique and full of soul, the most sensual dancing I've ever seen." The Hadza were involved in the only study that's compared well-being in a hunter-gatherer group whose life might be comparable to our distant ancestors with well-being in industrialized nations. Although their diet is generally pretty good, the Hadza otherwise subsist in material poverty. They own few possessions and live in temporary shelters made of dried grass and branches. Despite that, the study found that the Hadza people were happier than all 12 industrialized populations for which comparable scores are available. We should be careful when drawing conclusions about pre-agricultural hunter-gatherers from modern hunter-gatherers, because modern hunter-gatherers are different in several important respects. They live at environmental extremes, and they have conflicts with and trade with modern societies. Moreover, hunter-gatherer lifestyles vary widely, and the Hadza are especially harmonious, so they may not be representative, and this is only one study. The evidence is intriguing nonetheless. Perhaps the strongest evidence on hunter-gatherer happiness is qualitative. Ethnographers regularly comment on the apparent harmony and desirability of the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. A great drawback of being a pre-industrial hunter-gatherer was that, because of disease, occasional hunger, and the lack of modern medicine, life expectancy was much lower than it is today, though higher than in early agricultural societies. Around half of children born in pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer societies died before the age of 15, compared to 1 in 200 in Europe today. If a hunter-gatherer made it to age 15, they could expect to live until 53, whereas the average Brit, who makes it to 15 today, can expect to live until 89. Some scholars also argue that rates of violence were much higher among pre-agricultural hunter-gatherers, though this is fiercely disputed. Since the Industrial Revolution, there has been a clear upward trend in well-being, and this gives us good reason to believe that the world will continue to get better for people over at least the next century. On most economic forecasts, the world will continue to grow richer over the coming decades. Over the last 50 years, global GDP per person grew by 2% per year, and all major geographic areas are experiencing significant economic growth. In one recent survey of growth economists, the respondents thought that this trend would stay broadly the same, at 2.1% per year. Given this, by 2100, the average person will be 5 times richer than they are today, and so probably will also be happier. Over the course of the next century, at least, we have grounds for optimism.